The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, guitarist and composer Gary Lucas breathes new life into a nearly century-old vampire film.
Compelling, dark vision of, another world.
We'll learn about how farmers create a seasonal corn maze, and we'll take a trip to the weight room. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The 1932 Danish vampire movie Vampyr has remained an enduring, if obscure, classic in film history. Directed by Carl Theodor Dreyer, the film is mostly silent. Monster movie buffs today can watch a restored version of the film, which includes the score created by Wolfgang Zeller. But our next guest is taking the film in a different direction. Guitarist Gary Lucas is known for his work with Captain Beefheart and Jeff Buckley. He brings his otherworldly guitar sound to Dreyer's surreal masterpiece. I caught up with Gary ahead of a live score performance at the Racebrook Lodge in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
First of all, I was always a big Dracula fan and vampires in general. I definitely was influenced a lot in my younger days, seeing as many of these films as I could and reading the literature. So this film was a standout always in cinema guides to great horror films. And I guess I probably first caught it, I think I was in high school, in summer school, and they had a screening up in Andover, Massachusetts, in their summer program and taking a history of film course. So it really resonated with me. What can I say? It's both compelling, dark vision of, another world. You never really know if you're in a dream state throughout the film, or the brain of a madman, or a real, sort of graphic depiction of actual goings on.
The imagery is just wild, and there's dancing shadows and reflections, and there's skeletons moving on their own, and it's got so many different elements from Dracula mentioned around the same time. It's just so distinctly different. They're both vampire films, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah, no, it's very Danish, you could say, maybe. I don't know. But Dreyer, I went on to investigate his other films, and they all have something really dark and profound about them. And also, I read the book that the story appears in a collection by Sheridan Le Fanu's collection of supernatural stories, In a Glass Darkly. And I guess Bergman, did Through a Glass Darkly. So there's something in that neighborhood up there in Scandinavia, I think, that is peculiarly singular when it comes to portraying vampires. I can also, one of the last films that I saw in this genre in modern times was called Let the Right One In. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yeah, both versions.
About a girl in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're both great. So, it was calling out to me. Like, I really wanted to do something great musically to accompany this film. And, technically it is a sound film, but I played to it with the sound turned off. I didn't find that the soundtrack on the film enhanced the film terribly much, and that it was just as well enjoyed as a silent film with my music. So I hope you forgive me unless you're a film purist. You know, I'm always rubbing up against, especially in the silent film genre.
A lot of the audio in this film, there's very little dialogue.
And very little.
It was
very
overdubbed.
Little. Yeah, a couple of words.
On top of the, you know, in the 1930s. Yeah. And I just want to go back to Sheridan Le Fanu. He wrote Carmilla, and that predates Dracula by about 25 years or so.
Yeah.
So this is...
And then if you know your vampire films, you must know The Vampire Lovers with Ingrid Pitt, who was fantastic, and a few of the other... Well, you know, Hammer Horror regulars, that's based on Carmilla, too. It's more of a erotic vampire film, I guess. They took elements that were suggested in the lesbian inference department, but, you know, made them more explicit in the film. But, yeah, I have, you know, I got a collection of Le Fanu. So I read these stories when I was a boy, and I was like, fascinated. My favorite of all of these kind of transmogrification out of great literature, do you know the film Black Sunday?
I have not seen Black Sunday, no.
Oh my God, you got to see that.
I'll put it on my list.
Otherwise known as La Maschera del Demonio in Italian. It's an Italian horror film by Mario Bava with the great Barbara Steele, which so intrigued me and impressed me when I was a boy. I'm still talking about it, writing about it. But that one was based on a short story by Gogol, the Russian author, called The Vige, The Witch. Anyway, so I guess they were very inspired to source a lot of these stories out of classic literature. And yeah, I don't know any other film like Vampire quite like it. It's really a delightful film.
Yeah, so we had mentioned that it is almost like a silent film. There is sound, there is music, but there's also title cards. But when you were watching this film with the sound turned off and you're seeing such wild imagery, dream sequences, everything that's involved in this old horror film, how did you begin thinking about how it could be scored? Were you initially inspired by specific sequences in the film or maybe the mood of the film? When you're watching this with the sound turned off, how is the music forming in your head?
Well, a lot of times I'll just sit there in front of a flat screen, or in the old days, my Sony Trinitron or whatever I used, and I with a guitar in hand. And I would try and work up themes that seemed to go with overall mood or storyline or lead characters. You know, sometimes I would assign themes to different characters. So once I had my themes, I'd go through the film many times. Once I had a bunch of themes together that seemed appropriate, I am a very good improviser, so I figured out an approach, and it's like sort of that of a silent accompanist on the piano from the old days, whereby I juggle the themes with improvisation and make a continuous soundscape. I use a few effects that enable me to get very ethereal electronic textures at play when I'm performing with these films that also enhance the mood. The trick is sort of keep juggling the balls and keeping them all in the air, you know, so that a person watching it is not going to be overwhelmed by the score, but rather it's another component of enhancement to an appreciation of the film.
Why do you think it's important to revisit old works that are nearing, in this case, almost a century old? Why do you think that is important?
I think it's important because, number one, these films are fairly lost through the ages, except for cinema buffs or film historians. They don't get wide circulation. There's not a channel that shows. Well, that's not true. I mean, you know, Criterion or Mubi. There are some streaming channels now that show more silent era films, but nothing devoted to that. You'd think there would be, you know, in the best of all possible worlds. I mean, but that's my taste. So, you know, outside of occasional revivals by programmers in art house cinemas, one is not really, unless you're really adventurous, as far as like seeking them out, maybe getting a DVD copy on Amazon, you know, of a title that you've read about that might appeal to you, and then, you know, devouring it. I just think they're not greatly admired. You know, they're not in circulation much. You know, I'm a champion also of underdogs, and I love to shed light on obscure corners of culture and bring them back to life. So in that sense, I'm kind of a reanimator. You know, I'm trying to imbue the breath of life into these older works that are lying on shelves, you know, very moribund, you know, dusty shelves. And just put, you know, throw a spotlight on it and put it back into public consciousness. And one way of doing that is to reinvigorate these films with the new musical score.
You know, there something about that work that opens up a part of your brain that is maybe different from playing in a rock band kind of a setting when you're piecing this music together while you're also taking in a visual element? Does it feel like you're exercising a new part of your brain?
Yes, sure. I mean, to me, it's like I have a pretty vivid imagination, and I've certainly done a lot of work in creative music for a long time, but these are kind of my favorite projects. It's like strapping yourself onto a thrill ride when I get going. You know, the film starts, and I'm watching it really intently and playing at the same time, and I'm inspired as it progresses. Every time I see these films, I see something new in some little corner of the frame. They're just, you know, beautiful. And also, I try to cohabit with the spirit of the dead actors on the screen, you know, because I'm trying to get inside their heads and bring them back to life, you know, and kind of evoke the spirit of these actors with the music I'm playing. And it's like, there they go. They're dancing skeletons, you know, and now they will dance again.
Guitarist Gary Lucas on his reinvented score for Carl Dreyer's 1932 silent horror film, Vampyr. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Samascott family has been operating a farm and orchard in New York's Hudson Valley for more than a century. Today, the farm features a garden store, pick-your-own apples, and a fall family favorite, a corn maze. To learn more about the maze and how it's created, the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds took a trip to the farm.
On a warm autumn afternoon, Ron Samascott, his wife Bonnie Tedder, and their two dogs stand at the entrance of the corn maze, with mature corn towering overhead. The maze is a challenge open to seekers of all ages. The maze at Samascott's is known for its intricate designs. Each year, Bonnie creates a drawing on graph paper. This year's design is a potted strawberry plant. The farm is known for its strawberries that are available into the fall. Once the design is completed and the pathways are drawn on paper, Ron gets to work creating the Maze Maze. The couple told me about their creative process.
It is a job to come up with what it's going to be. And sometimes you have good ideas, but it's hard to turn them into a drawing. And that's where, you know, she has to try to figure out how to do it.
It takes about a week to make the drawing after Ron's tweaks. And then I hand it over to Ron so he can perform his amazing magic.
Yeah, she does a really good job. She's a good artist, great artist. But sometimes she'll leave like a big blank spot. I said, Bonnie, you've got to have trails over there. You know, why waste the whole field?
You know, that's where you come in.
It's a process doing the drawing.
Ron then details how after the drawing is finished, how he then plants and grows the corn.
You know, most people when you plant corn, there's a lot of rows all parallel to each other. When we plant the corn for the maize, we plant the field in that method with all rows one way, but then we go the opposite 90-degree angle to that and plant the same amount of rows again. So it's twice as much corn as a normal field, but it comes out in a nice grid. Not just like the graph paper. So I just take the drawings on the graph paper, you know, it won't look like this, it'll have a whole bunch of little lines on it, and then I'll mark off where, like each little square, I think it's 8 rows of corn. So I can say, all right, I've got a dot there, and then 7 squares over, that's another 56 rows of corn. I count over and go to that point, and you know, and it works out fairly well. You can go out. I go out with basically it's just like the driveway marker, plastic pole with a reflector on the top. I do it when the corn is short. You know, maybe try to do it before it gets above 2 or 3 feet.
Ron's system of creating the maze utilizes math, machinery, and years of experience. Once the design is decided and the driveway markers are in place, Ron brings out the mower.
So you put the driveway markers in the various spots, drive between the markers we have a zero turn mower, the same thing we mow the lawn with at the store and at the farm, and it's a 6-foot wide mower, so it cuts us, you know, every path is about 6 feet wide, and I just follow these. I do it in sections, you know, I'll do like I try to do the flower pot first and then go out and fill in all the lines, different areas, and straight lines are always nice. You know, I can put a point there and a point there and just zoom. But as you can see, this one doesn't have a whole lot of straight lines, and it's a challenge when they're so crooked like that. So, and it, you know, sometimes it might vary a bit from the drawing, you know, just to try to make sure the lines aren't too close together, you know, so you can just look through a few rows and see the next path, you know.
And then he mows it like every week or so.
Well, I probably only mow it about 3 or 4 times. It's usually, the corn's probably 2 or 3 feet tall when we mow it, but it does regrow. So I have to go back a week or two later and mow it. But that's easy once you've got it marked out. You can just, because even when it regrows, it'll still be a lot smaller and it's easy to tell. And you can ride through and remow it. And then I have to remow it a couple times before we open, because grass and weeds and things will come up. And still, some of the corn comes up even after you mow it off a second or third time. Sprout back again, you know, the roots. Corn is a pretty hardy plant. And as you can see, I mean, this is, some of it's probably 10 feet high.
Yeah, it's tall.
Perhaps unlike some larger farms, Semascott's does not have a GPS-guided planter. That's why the design has to be cut out of the field when the corn is young. In recent years, Ron's son Jake began using an aerial drone to see if the cut is accurate. To make a successful maize, you need a strong corn crop, without bare patches or standing water. And as Ron explains, good weather helps too.
In this field, the main drawback is if it rains a lot, there's spots that'll get, because this is a low-lying thing. We're not much above the creek level. So when it rains a lot of water will sit in certain spots, and then the corn won't grow. If the corn's too wet, it gets stunted, it just doesn't grow. And if it does it when it's really young, it'll die. Generally, if corn's big enough, like this year, the corn grew to 3 feet when there were no real wet periods. We got some wet periods after that, but the corn was big enough that it sucked most of the moisture out of the ground, so it didn't really bother the corn, you know. Because once corn starts growing, it needs a lot of water. To get that big, in a couple of months. Is
so bad with the water that we've had to pump it out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We've kind of rearranged the topography a little so that that one real low spot isn't so low anymore. You know, there used to be a spot right in the middle that was lower than the rest, and the water would just sit there, and that spot would sometimes be like a pond. But we've kind of pushed the dirt in from the sides and tried to level it out so the water spreads out more and it's not all in one spot.
You know? Well, that, I would have to make my drawing with that void of corn there.
Before we leveled it out.
Had to incorporate that into the drawing.
That's spot. Always a challenge, too. You know, try to do a drawing and, well, you can't make any lines here because it's because it's so wet.
There's more to the maze than just finding your way out. Guests are given a punch card. To win a prize, maze goers must find each hole punch in the field to mark their card.
We have eight different spots throughout the maze. We have a little fact sheet about whatever we've decided in the shirt Strauber is. And there's also a punch thing at each station. So when the people find every punch, we give them a card when they go in. It has the eight. Each punch has a different shape. And when they punch each hole, then they get a free small ice cream when they complete the maze. And a lot of people, say most people do find everything. Well, some of them spend a lot of time, but they do find most of them. But some people give up. I mean, it is hard. You know, it's work. You know, kids like it on a cool, you know, day like today, you might not like it because it is so hot, but you know, on a cool day, it's a fun thing to do. You get out and you get exercise. And I've gone out, you know, when I've been working on it with the dogs, and the dogs love it. They run through all the trails.
The maze can be difficult to complete, let alone finding every punch station. Ron and Bonnie say difficulty does vary from year to year, depending on the design.
This one, I believe, is the most difficult of all the ones I've done. Because there's so many avenues to get lost.
There's certain spots that when you're there, you really can't, especially when the corn is tall like it is this year. Some place, from some spots in this maze, you can't see the trees around you. You know, sometimes you can see the buildings or the, you know, okay, these trees are up near the buildings. Those trees are in the backfield. But in some spots, the corn's so tall, you just can't see the buildings. And you can't really even tell whether you're facing where the entrance was or the other way, or, you know, it can be, and especially if it's a cloudy day and the sun's not out, you know, you can't go by the sun either. You know, it's a,
you go round and round in circles without an out.
It's these kind of areas where it's so many things all together, but you really, you know, it's thick enough that you can't really see through it, but you go around there and you don't realize sometimes when you do all these zigzags, sometimes you go all the way around and you don't know if you've gone around in a circle or not. You know, it's hard.
Yeah. Fun.
But I think some people spend so much time, sometimes they say, hey, I've been here. You know, I recognize that that spot or that broken stalk of corn.
What would you say is the part that you enjoy most about the corn maze, maybe in the process of creating it or when it's done?
I like when it's done.
For the best of our knowledge, I'm Madeline Reynolds.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. The National Foundation for Governors Fitness Councils wants kids to get active. The organization's multi-million-dollar Don't Quit program is helping to bring new fitness facilities to public school districts across the country. In New York, a 1,000-square-foot Don't Quit weight room was recently opened at Troy Middle School. The Best of Our Knowledge's Samantha Simmons reports.
The school's new Don't Quit Fitness Center is outfitted with weights, machines, and stationary bikes. Troy Middle School is one of three schools in the state to receive a center, along with Saranac Central School and Hamlin Park School 74 in Buffalo. Principal Ian McShane calls the center a game changer.
Our push for so long was academics. Then we realized that there's a whole other part to the kid besides just the instruction that's in front of them. And while all that stuff is critical, this stuff is critical also. So we're trying to build time into our day to give them an opportunity to move around, you know, get their bodies moving, work together, the teamwork that results from it.
The 1,000 square foot weight room is financed by the National Foundation for Governors Fitness Councils through public-private partnerships. Applications for the weight room required a video illustrating need while being informative and creative, along with a short written section that includes the current state of the school's current fitness center. McShane says their video focused on the relationship between mental and physical health.
I guess it resonated with the Don't Fit, Don't Quit organization, and we're fortunate enough to be here today.
Jake Steinfeld is the chairman of the National Foundation for Governors Fitness Councils. He says more than 116 schools in the state applied. He says exercise is an underused antidepressant.
If you're angry, mad, sad, or stressed, move your body. And it begins right in here. And one rep leads to two reps, and all of a sudden you're feeling great about yourself and you can achieve anything you want in your life if you don't quit.
A group of student representatives from the middle school took their turn getting their reps in. Eighth grader Kiana Tiernan is on the varsity basketball team. She says the weight room will support her efforts to become a better baller.
I'm probably going to use it for my running and my strength and, like, probably help my strength, my ball handling and stuff.
And your old fitness center, how is this an upgrade from it?
It's upgrade because we definitely got newer equipment. The old gym wasn't as nice and the equipment didn't work as well. But since we got the new upgraded stuff, it works a lot better now.
Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Samantha Simmons.
If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1776. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.